Welcome to Nairobi Book Love, the podcast episode. Again, I never know what episode, what is going to be which episode. So listen, welcome to an episode of Nairobi Book Love.
Ain't no city like my city. No.
We got the need to read.
They can do it like we do it in the 254.
Nairobi Book Love, the podcast.
Nairobi, Tukorada, Rada.
Welcome to Nairobi Book Love, the podcast.
The world of imagination is awesome.
And today I have a super special guest, a book that I read yesterday. Yes, so I'm going to, without further ado, before I get into what the book is, a very, very warm welcome to Kenya's very own award-winning author, Mr. Kinyanjui Kombani.
Hi, Koi. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for getting honest. So first of all, what do I call you? Do I call you Kinyanjui? Do I call you Kombani? Kinya? Do you have like a nickname?
Which one? A lot of people call me many names. My campus nickname was the Showstopper. People who know me from way back call me Jokin. People from the office call me Kombani or KK. So which one works for you?
I like KK because I have a friend of mine called Karai and we call him KK. Good. I like KK. Let's do that one.
Good.
And well, also, good. Oh, by the way, I'm a KK as well because yep. I'm Kwe Kabala.
Yeah, good. We have a lot in common.
Perfect. Okay, KK, let's get into this. So I was going to say, I was doing, in fact, the very first episode of the podcast, I was recording G-Money. And I was at his house. I go to look at his bookshelf and I find a book. I mean, there were typical books. There was a Jay-Z book. There was a Reggae Cookbook. And then he had The Last Villains of Molo. And I'm ashamed to say I'd never heard of the book. I'd heard of the author. I've definitely heard of you, but I hadn't heard about this book. So I got curious and I bought it off Kindle. Amazon.
Oh, great.
I did. Yeah. And it was $349. So, yeah, it was about 400 bob. And I was like, okay, this is pretty dope. And I started reading it yesterday and I finished the entire book.
Okay.
222 pages. It was a very easy read, actually.
Yeah, it is. It's an easy read. I think, and even the one that I have latest is easier than that as well. So, yep.
Okay, nice. Now that I've read this one, I'm definitely going to read the other. I'll read the other one. So, The Last Villains of Molo. So, when I started reading the book, I was like, okay, so this is going to be a book about, you know, a bunch of thugs in the hood. Okay, that's okay. Let me see that thug life. My life as a criminal, sort of. But then again, the story unfolds and it unfolds and you get sucked in. And I really, really enjoy it. So, let me first start by saying you wrote a good piece of work and I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed reading the book.
Thanks. It was my first work of fiction.
So let me start with Last Villains of Molo. So when did you write the book?
So the book was written between 2001 and 2002.
Okay.
So I was in my second year of campus. Yeah.
Oh, you wrote this in your
second year? Yeah, I was in KU. Yes, I was in KU.
So KK, Kenyatta University. Instead of, going out and enjoying life and doing silly campus things, you are writing a book.
Yeah, it was actually interesting because I didn't know I could write professionally. So I had done two short stories and I gave them to my lecturer who recently died. It's called Gashanja Kiai, and I asked him if he could have a look. But instead of him having a look and just saying, this is okay, he came to with the two stories in class and he told the class that he just received the best work he's ever seen in his life, and then he asked the class to read the two stories, and that actually inspired me a lot. And then he gave me the number of a publisher. I went to see the publisher. The publisher told me he likes the stories, but the market doesn't really like short stories, and he asked me if I could do a novel. At that point, I had already started thinking about a short story about the clashes in Molo. So what happened is that I simply just said, okay, I just blurted out that I have a novel that I'm writing about Molo. So I had to find a way of increasing the word count from the short story to the novel. So that's the story of how the story was written. Yeah.
Okay, so to give a brief synopsis, in fact, you're better suited. Give us like a brief synopsis of The Last Villains of Molo, like what the book is about.
Yeah. Yeah, so a lot of people know about the post-election violence that was there in 2007, that was countrywide. But the bigger sort of election crisis that we had was in 1992 in Molo. So the story is based on that on that incident that happened in Molo in 1992. And what I've done is that I got two stories in one. So one story is about some young men who are in Nairobi, who are just basically thugs in Nairobi. And another one is about the clashes in Molo, and I put them together into one story because I've always wanted a story about rich girl meets poor boy, and I wanted to have that in the story. So that has always been a concern for me, rich girl meets poor boy, yeah.
Okay.
So I put the two of them together, yeah. So it's more of a story about what the clashes happened, and then not just that, but even what is the impact of the clashes on the people who were then youngsters and not old, and what is the impact on them right now.
Wow. So this book, you wrote it 2001-2002. So, but it was published 2008, I believe?
Yes, it was published 6 years later. By the time it was published, we actually had had the post-election violence. So the post-election violence kind of inspired the publisher to finally release it.
Wait, so after after you wrote the story, which took you about a year, which is incredible, to write an entire novel in a year, that's no mean feat. So you'd already been referred to by your lecturer, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So why did they sit on the book for 6 years?
Several reasons. One of them is the publisher didn't have the budget, so he said that, you know, he has to look for money to publish it. And the second was he didn't think that Kenya was ready for such a conversation about clashes, because my book talks about, you know, there's a lot of tribal undertones. You know, I don't hide behind a fake tribe by just putting Kikuyus and Kalenjins right there and mention some of the stereotypes that were happening and some of the killings that were happening. He didn't think that the country was ready to have a conversation around tribe.
Okay. Yep. And you know what?
So
perhaps the country wasn't ready for a conversation about tribe. It's interesting. I was talking to Shiro Kwinange. She wrote now a book. Have you read it, Havoc of Choice?
I have bought it, obviously, because it's not available on Kindle yet. I've bought the physical copy. I'm just waiting for a shipment to come from Kenya. It's actually been added to my shipment of books, yeah. But I kind of know the storyline from your post the other day.
Oh, did you listen to the podcast?
Yeah.
I've not
listened to the podcast because I want to read the book first and then I listen to the podcast.
Yeah, I agree. But when we were having that conversation, it's interesting you said that. She said that she quoted someone who said it takes people about 8 years to come to reckoning with a traumatic event. And it was interesting because even for her, it took her about 8 years to, you know, write the entire book. So maybe that entire, maybe at that time, we actually were not ready for that conversation. But that's one of the best aspects of the book, honestly, for me, is because.
Yeah, I don't know even now if you're ready. Yeah.
I like the fact that there was no hiding, because fact of the matter is these are the things that happened. These are the conversations that people are having. And the sooner that we have those conversations and deal with these issues head on, the sooner we move on, isn't it?
Yeah. And I've gotten a lot of feedback from people from both sides of the divide. So I've gotten people who are Kalenjins, people who are Kikuyu. And there's mixed feelings. Some people say, you know, you are too harsh on us. Others say you are too soft on us, because I know at least I personally killed a few people from the other tribe. So people have a lot of feedback on that kind of conversation.
Okay. Yep. So 6 years later, the publisher is like, okay, we're ready. What prompted them? Is it that you're saying basically the 2007-2008 now, you know, which was an unfortunate enactment of what happened in 1992?
So I think that's what spurred on the publisher, and he said, you know, I think now we should release it. I think a lot of things aligned. First of all, he got money from somewhere. Secondly, I got approached by another publisher. So I had sent the book to three different publishers. And one of them the first publisher reached out to me first. So you'll notice that the book is now published by Longhorn.
Yes.
But Longhorn was not the first publisher. The first publisher was Acacia. So I sent it to Acacia. Acacia is the one who released the first book. But then we got into some disagreements later. But I had also given it to another publisher called East Africa Publishers. And East Africa Publishers took about 2 or 3 years to get back to me on whether they are going to publish the book or not. By which time I had already started working with this publisher. And what happened is that when East Africa Publishers came back to me, I told my publisher, you know, East Africa Publishers has come back to me and they want to publish the book. He quickly made me sign up. We had not even signed a contract with him. He quickly made me sign a contract and told me, now, since the publishers are looking for you, we might as well release it now. Mm. Yeah, so it's I can call it a series of events that actually, you know, made him now just say to release the book.
Okay. Yeah. I guess everything does happen in its own time.
Yes, that's what I've discovered now in my old age. Yeah.
Your old age indeed. So I guess when I was reading up about you, it says you grew up in Molo.
Mm.
And then now you moved in with your brothers at some point in Gando, which is like an informal settlement.
Yes. So I spent my first 15 years in Molo.
Okay. Before now moving to Gando. So I guess my question now would be, this story in Last Villains of Molo, is it a personal story?
So there's a lot of my person intertwined in the story. There are so many things that you read there, and if you know me, you know that's me. I didn't know any alternative world. I didn't know any other slum in Nairobi. So initially, my first setting I had put in a different name for Gando. I didn't want to use Gando because I thought that in books you actually have to use a fake name. Mm. You don't have to use the real name. But my publisher asked me, because he said that the description of Gando is so vivid that he feels that that place exists. So he asked me if the place exists. And then I told him, yes, it exists. He told me, okay, can you use the actual name of the place? And at some point, he actually went into Gando himself, because he used to live in Ngong, and he passed by Gando. It's somewhere near the Ngong race course. So he actually passed by there to see if that story exists, and he actually saw that the place exactly as I described it. So a lot of things are intertwined in the story. For instance, and I know at this point now we are starting to give spoilers to people who have not read the book.
So there's a story about the book first.
Yes. So there's a place in the story where one of the characters, who is not Kikuyu, not Kalenjin, and his Luya, he's the only Luya person, is Getaya. So he's picked from the village, from town where he was just walking around doing his own stuff, and taken to fight in the forest. So that actually happened to my brother. My elder brother was with my sister walking around in town, and then they were thrown into a lorry, and that experience that Ngeta had in the forest is actually my own brother's. And what saved him is that he had a long coat in the past. I don't want to guess your age, but I'm thinking that people who are over 30 will tell you that there was in the 90s, 2000, there was a kind of a jacket which was very popular, which is a jacket that had a big at the back there was like a mane, like a lion's mane. Mm-hmm. So that was very popular, and that was what he was wearing, and an arrow got stuck there. That's actually what saved him, otherwise he would have died. Because the person thought that he'd killed him. So that was actually my brother's own experience, and the way he explained, together with exactly how they were conned, how they were taken round by somebody who could speak Kikuyu, and how they were attacked. So a lot of that is actually what happened in real life. Because when I was writing the story, I was just trying to make it as live as possible. So there's a lot of me in that story in terms of those experiences. When I was talking about Marigiti and how the young man went to Marigiti, around that time I had started a greengrocer in Gando, and I used to go to Marigiti to collect mangoes, to buy mangoes for sale. And so those things that I was writing about Marigiti were things that I was experiencing myself. There's a story about the camps, the IDP camps, where there was a lot of poverty. And I was there's an example used about a woman who was giving another one chapati like that, and that actually was my mother's story when she was talking about how poor they were. So there's a lot of my story intertwined there. Plus also the other thing also is that I had a roommate in campus who was a victim of the clashes. And the story about them sleeping in the Napier grass at night and all that was actually things that he was telling me about what happened to him. So there's a lot of, actually that story has a lot of real life experiences.
And you can tell because when you read the story, it feels really authentic, you know? It feels real and it feels true. So yeah, I'm not surprised that it's definitely experiences from different places. Because I saw in the forward, is it the forward of the book where you're talking about the sources of some of your stories?
Yeah. And one of them was an old man called Joseph Mbue, who died recently, and his family had been resettled. So he was affected by the clashes in 1997, not 1992. 1997, and they came to stay at our place in Njoro. So my home is in Njoro. They came to stay there, and he used to tell me about the clashes that were in Molo and how the first day happened, the very first day of the clashes. So in fact, when I was telling you about that, I wanted to do a short story about Molo clashes. That was where I wanted to I was just talking about the first day of the clashes, and that's what my short story was going to be based on. Yeah, so there's a lot of me in that story and people around me.
I love it. So I guess I would ask you, are you rock? Are you bone?
No, actually, the thing is that I don't know who I am. So people ask me and I don't know who I am. I think there's a bit of me in everyone. What I can't do is that I cannot mug anybody. I don't have the body for that. By the time I was writing the story, I was very skinny. Yeah, I was just saying, and actually even those guys who are there in the story, people like Ghosty are people who exist in their life. Wow. There was a guy who actually was, so I used to play pool a lot when I finished high school. And those characters that were playing pool are actually real life characters. The Ghosty exists, the Slaughterhouse exists. There was a guy. Yeah, the Slaughterhouse exists.
Did you live in the Slaughterhouse?
Now I'm going to incriminate myself because of the things that are happening in the slaughterhouse, right?
Yes.
And there was even a guy who had gotten married to a white man. He was called Jama. Uh-huh. And that actually guy exists. He used to be there. So those are characters that I was waking up to the morning to play pool with. Mm. Just that I knew that they will never ever read the book. There was no chance of them ever reading the book, and that's why I put them in as is. I'm sure if somebody was to go there, he would actually sue me, but sue me would actually admit him that he was doing those things that
true
were happening in Gando. Yeah.
Very clever. Yeah. I love that. You know, cause the slaughterhouse is so vivid to me, and even the night that the Slaughterhouse Five meets Nancy, what's the name of the pub? That pub that they like to hang out. Start with a T.
Tiongos.
Was it
Tiongos?
That's what they used to
play. The pool place. It's called Tiongos because there's a guy called Tiongo who used to own a pool table. So there was nothing that I was faking. It was things that really existed. Yeah.
I love that. I really, really like that.
Yeah.
Okay. So Nancy, is Nancy real?
Nancy is not real. So Nancy was not real. The characters in Nairobi were mostly made up because I had to find a way of. Like I said, I love a story about rich girl, poor boy, and I had to find a way of doing that. Because you see the thing with living where I was staying, the gentleman who's called Jama, okay, obviously that's a fake name, but the gentleman who's called Jama, everyone was looking up to him because he was, let me use the word hustler, because although it has been changed nowadays, but he was a hustler like the rest of us. And suddenly he's coming there in, you know, designer wear. He has a car parked there to play pool. He used to pay my rent because I used to shoot pool with him, betting. So I used to bet with him. So every time I'm asked to pay the rent, I would refuse to pay the rent so that I can wait for him. And then I win some games and multiply my money. So he could bet, you know, like 1,000 shillings per game and things like that. So those are people that really existed. Yeah.
That's incredible. Because you know,
so
I read
Tiongos
this book.
Existed, yeah.
I read this book yesterday, so it's really fresh in my mind. So to think that all that actually takes place, this needs to be a movie, by the way. This needs to be a movie.
Oh. We've been trying to get it into a film. We've optioned for it several times. Mm-hmm. The big challenge that we have is that the producers who looked at it, I've had a couple of conversations with producers, is that they want it to be as authentic as possible, which means they will actually have to build villages and burn them down. and the cost of doing that and then if you consider the returns from the movie industry, it has to be basically something that is done for love, not for money.
Agreed.
Because it needs to, because they want to do it as you know, war. There has to be war as it's described in the story, with hundreds of men, hundreds of actors, you know, burning helicopters and all that. So the cost is actually prohibitive.
Agreed. Okay. Yep. But the same way it took you 8 years to get the 6 years to get the book published, I'm pretty sure eventually the movie will come to fruition. In fact,
it will happen. I think its own space. My whole dream was to have my book on a bookshop somewhere. I never even thought it was going to go the way it has gone right now. So
yeah.
I believe in everything at its own time. Yeah.
Agreed. Completely agree. Okay. Yeah. So we've talked about the research process for the story. I know you've talked about your roommate. There was an old man. Some of them are your personal experiences. Did you have any other, experiences?
Or rather, experiences.
What else made up the research process from the story?
So a lot of it, actually, I dug into the Daily Nation library. So I don't know if they still have it, but they had a library where they had all the newspapers from the word go. So I spent months every day going to the library. Apart from interviewing people, I actually went to the library and read all the dailies from those days of 1992. Yeah, that actually helped me to build the story.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Which I guess which is fair enough. So my other question would be, gosh, I have so many. We already also touched on the publishing aspect. And how difficult it is, honestly, to publish a book in Kenya. So if you were to do...
It's very difficult. Yeah.
If you had to do it all over again, what would you do differently?
I think it's very hard to say what I would do differently, because it is the same issue that unknown writers have. So if I was unknown, right now I'm in a very good place because I can dictate terms with the publisher. I have direct access to the CEO of publishing houses. I can tell them, you know, my book is delaying or something like that, which I didn't have when I was starting out. And I can convince them, you know, release this book because I know it will sell 3,000 copies in a week, which is good news for Kenyan publishing, because if you sell 1,000 copies in a year, you're a bestseller. So I didn't have that, so I don't know what I would do different in a year. Yeah. So and the last book that I did, we sold 3,000 in a week. So because of that selling power, it has been easier for me. So I don't know what I would do differently. I would be wiser to be a bit more patient, because when I published with my first publisher, after some time I realized he was not going to pay me my royalties, and after some push, a bit of push and shove, we agreed to part ways, and then I moved the book back to Longhorn, who had initially rejected the book. So the thing is, I don't know what I would do differently, but I would be a bit wiser in terms of before I sign on that dotted line, before I agree to some changes. There are so many changes in the book. You would not know this, but the book is actually 2/3 of what it was. So we had to reduce the book, but we had to reduce a third of it. So there's a place in the story that everything looks very hurried, and it's because we had to reduce about 10 chapters into one page. Yeah.
Why?
And that's why there's a special character who everyone loves and who died in the middle of the story, just like that suddenly, which I'm sure you're going to ask me about.
The character who died first was...
Yeah.
Was it Bobo or was it Bafu? Bafu died first.
No, the girl.
Oh, Stella. When
yeah,
she was hit
yeah.
by the bus.
So... Yeah, so it was so sudden and it was so unexpected, but that had to happen because she plays a very big role. In the original story, she played a very big role at the end. So that's why she had to die, because there was no way of reducing a third of the story with her still being part of it.
Okay, wait a minute.
So some of those things I would do differently,
So now, if Stella died, I'm assuming Stella died to make way for the relationship between Bone and Nancy, right?
Yes.
Okay, so either way,
but
she had to die or had to like move out of the picture.
Yes, because in the so the storyline in the end is very different from what it is right now. It didn't end in reconciliation. It ended with the death of everyone, including Nancy. But the publisher said, you know, you have to give people some hope. You know, you don't just kill everyone just like that. And the person who rescues Bone is actually Stella. So when we decided to change the storyline to make people survive, then we had also to remove Stella at the beginning of the story.
Okay.
In the middle of the story, yeah. So it one of the saddest things that I had was to kill Stella.
It's interesting because...
And I didn't know how else to do it, yeah.
I think it was done well because Stella's death made Bone not really a hated figure, but yeah, for a bit, people really disliked him. And that kind of drove him to Imara Daima, to where now Nancy was staying. So it felt like a more natural way for him to now seek solace in another woman's arms, because now he's also feeling guilty for the death of Stella, although in essence, he had nothing to do with that. Okay.
So yeah. So in the original manuscript, actually, Nancy is the one who killed Stella.
Oh, are you going to release?
So that's the original story.
Are you going to release the original manuscript somewhere on the dark web?
The last chapters, maybe. the last chapter, maybe it should, maybe it should appear there, yeah.
I think that would be the alternate ending. I think that would be very interesting.
Yeah, it was. But I think what I've seen with societies love happy endings.
Yes, we do.
No pun intended. Yeah. Yep.
But at the end of the day, you know, I mean, there's been very few happy endings, especially because almost every election we see the same thing happen again. Maybe not to a large extent, but Molo has remained a very volatile area, which is quite sad.
Yeah.
Which is really.
And if you ask me, actually, I think that is the main weakness of the story, because the story's ending is actually a weakness in itself. Because it assumes that, you know, we have killed each other, I've killed your parents, you've killed my parents, let's just get married and go and rebuild, which does not happen in real life. In real life, we have people who've lost everything they had, they've lost their family members, and every year they are likely to see the same thing happening. Now, right now, Molo is under tension because of the current political climate. And I'm just seeing, today I've just seen somebody selling his property. So people are starting to sell properties. In 2000 and in every 5 years, the property markets go down. The property prices go down because people are trying to dispose of their property. So there's no happy ending in real life. So that was one of the things that for me, I find a weakness in the story. There's no happy ending in real life. And for me, it's worrying that, you know, people who lost their parents in 2000, imagine my roommate, now he's over 35 years. Not only can he defend himself and his family, but he can also take arms and, you know, attack the neighbor. So it's only happy, we're only happy that 2013, we didn't have any clashes, and 17, 2022, there's a lot of tension. Yeah.
Still up in the air, but that's it's cyclic.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's, I guess, my
It is.
My next question would be then, because the book is set in 1992, isn't it? And it's published just around the time we have now the next post-election violence. And so would you consider, because I know when I was reading up about Den of Iniquities, it's sort of almost supposed to pick up where that other story left off. But primarily for the characters of this book, would you want to do a sequel to Last Villains of Molo?
I don't know because what would the sequel look like? Because I don't want to do another feel good story, and I don't want to do a tragedy. After I wrote Den of Iniquities and I wrote Last Villains of Molo, I think one of the reviewers actually said, you know, you run the risk of being known for writing sad stories, or, you know, this kind of stories that are not nice. And that's why my latest novel was more of a comedy. It was just trying to tell myself that I can actually move away from, you know, negativity and talk about happy things and humor for a change. So I don't know what it would be, because it would not be sugarcoating things. It would be, you know, I don't know what the sequel would be. What would the story look like? Because I don't know how 2022 will look like. I don't know if I would end it in, you know, in reconciliation anymore, because I don't know how to reconcile. There are so many things that I also could not put in the story. Maybe one of the things that, now that you mentioned it, would actually be to probably just write the things that I was not able to put in the story, because I was still worried. Remember the context of the time was right in the Las Vegas of Molo. We were still in the Moi era, where one of the things that I was worried about is that this story will come out and I have to go into exile, and I don't have money even for a passport. So how do I go into exile? So those were the times, yeah.
Oh, those are legit concerns.
Yeah. Because the only person I knew who I had heard about was Koi Wamwere, who had gone into exile. Yeah. I didn't want to be like him. Yeah.
Go give us Yomo.
Yeah.
Okay.
So but Koigi is much more dramatic.
Speaking of, you know, the tragedy of it, because some of the scenes, there's some very vivid and very disturbing scenes in the book, you know? Everything is described from, you know, the brutal death. I remember there's one part of the book, and that really, it broke my heart. When it's Ngeta, I believe, who's running back, then he was called Lihun. Lihanda, there we go. Back when he was Lihanda, and he's running because they're all running, and they're in the forest, and because they have come for an attack. It's the time when they've been collected to come and, you know, retaliate and against the wrongs that they feel they've been wronged. And he's running, and then the book describes he hears a slosh, you know, like a wetness. And when he looks behind, it's an older man with a beard, and he's been shot by an arrow, so there's blood pooling in his gumboots. So as he walks, you can hear that sloshing sound. That was very vivid for me, mostly because my grandfather who lives in Kinango, he's a gumboots kind of guy. And I remember once when it was raining and, you know, your gumboots fill with mud, and when you're running, you can feel the slosh. So I was trying to imagine, it's not water, it's blood, you know? And it was such...
And that was actually... All that was actually what my brother told me about what he had witnessed. And from then on, he went on to, you know, like, get... into alcohol in a major way, and he actually died much later. But that was, I think, probably that was one of the traumatic things that made him, you know, go that way. Those are the things that he saw. Everything that happened in that village is actually things that he saw.
Even the when that time when Irungu and his family, they're being transported after hiding out in the, you know, even that hiding out at night in the fields, because you're so fearful to get into your houses because they'll be burnt. And then finally there's a businessman who donates a bus, and he says, okay, you guys come, you know, he'll take you. And then of course they find a roadblock, and I remember when it's written, the way the stone just smashes the windscreen, and, you know, the driver is shot by an arrow, so he can't even drive, and now everyone has to run in different directions, and yet the car is surrounded. And, you know, you're hit by an arrow on your back as you're running. And then now you're in pain. You just... Like, Irungu, now he collapsed and he was ready to die. So, scenes like... There's some quite... Let me just say there's some scenes in the book.
And mine, the one that I saw personally... So, two things that I saw. I was very young. I think I was about 10 years. Yeah, I was 10 years old. So, I remember my mother used to... supply things at the district hospital, and one day when we were there trying to follow up on some payment, we actually saw the victim who had an arrow stuck in his forehead going all the way to the nose. Remember that part?
Yes.
That part actually is, that was me who saw that. My landlord, where we used to stay, the landlord had a big compound. It was, everyone just came, and they didn't even ask him. They just came in and packed their food things there and started living in his compound, and he could not do anything about it. And that was the way it was in Molo Town. You could not even stop people. There was no even people coming to ask, you know, can we stay here? They would just come and camp outside your house. It's a place that I would not like Kenya to go back to.
And yet we have gone back to it several times, you know.
It's
very dark. So I guess what was your therapy like? Because when you hear these stories, and some of them you witness, how are you able to just reconcile with what you have seen?
There's nothing that I did, and I don't know if that has caused any kind of trauma on my side, because the good thing is that I was not personally affected. I was seeing this as an outsider, because we used to stay in Molo Town, so I never got, and the clashes were happening in the outskirts. So what we are getting mostly were people coming into the town and that's what I was actually seeing and what was happening in the hospital. But I don't have the kind of trauma that my roommate has, because my roommate has a lot of trauma. He was really affected by his family disintegrated. His son was sleeping in the Napier grass. So even as at the time we were with him in campus, he could not sleep with the lights off, and we used to fight a lot until I discovered that actually was the issue that he had. So myself, I don't know if I have any trauma or I did any kind of therapy. I think also writing the book was kind of therapeutic, if I can talk about it, because so, I don't have any challenges, any and I'm lucky about that. Yeah.
You are, yeah. It's just, so Molo town wasn't as affected as now, the guys who were in the villages, you know, in the more interior places.
So Molo town was predominantly Kikuyu. So the people who are non-Kikuyu, especially those who are Kalenjin in Molo town, had to leave the town. One of my neighbors was a teacher, and my brother, who was my elder brother, he was actually asked to go, you know, to that place and stay in the house. So you remember there's a place in the book where there's a teacher and the Walimuro teacher, and some people came to stay in his house.
Yes.
So our neighbor didn't die, but that idea of, you know, leaving your neighbors to go and look after your house on your behalf, that concept actually came from my own neighbor, because we were staying then. I remember because I come from a very humble background, so we didn't have food. So the only thing that he told us, you know, there is food in the house, you can eat the food as much as you want. Yeah. So we actually practically lived in that person's house for some time, trying to protect it from the people who would actually come and, you know, and start attacking them. Yeah.
Wow. Well, this is our history. It is ours. We must own it and, you know, just be better for it. So once the book came out, obviously the reception has, you know, was quite amazing. So, I mean, the awards have come in. There's been a lot of recognition. So what are some of the highlights post-publication for you for this book, for this whole journey, really?
I think the biggest thing that I think the book has done for me is just opening doors, because the fact that opened door for me and so it opened many doors to many other things. So right now, if I have any book that I want to be released, it's easier. It's 100 times easier for me to get it published. I now work with 6 publishers, and I have an open door policy with any one of them. Even the one I'm writing right now, the publisher has already said, you know, publish, write it, we'll publish it. So that for me was actually the biggest thing that the book did for me. The other highlight was The Guardian naming it as one of the top 10 books in Kenya since independence, with names such as Ngugi wa Thiong'o there. And I think that actually was a big thing for me. Opportunities to go and speak about it in campuses, you know, being taught in universities in Kenya, in Germany. Somebody doing a PhD based on the book in a University of Oxford, you know, all those things are things that came as a surprise to me, because like I told you, all I wanted was to see the book in bookshop. That was the extent of my dreams, you know. That was my extent of my ambition. Yeah,
that's fantastic. Because I did.
Then it has opened up all these other doors. Yeah, yeah.
I saw that. It is a course text. They actually study it in universities in Kenya and in Germany. And even when you Google the book, you will find a thesis that someone has done.
Yeah, there are many people. And some of those theses, I tell you, I don't even understand those theses. Like the titles will actually scare me. The ethnocentrist is something of the last villains of Molo. And I just look at them and I say, okay. And then also students in universities reach out to me on social media and ask me to help them with questions that they are answering. And I can't answer those questions myself. So it's interesting to see that kind of discussion happening about something you wrote.
It's fantastic. I know you've written several books now. After Last Villains of Molo came Den of Iniquities. After that came Of Pawns and Players, isn't it?
Yeah, Pawns and Players is my fourth novel.
Which one?
You've missed out one that has not yet been released. So I submitted it in 2016. Mm-hmm. It is still being in the kitchen. So my fourth novel came out before my third novel.
That's interesting.
And then I have other books, children's books. I've done a book on Wangari Maathai. Four young adult novels. One of which won the Jomo Kenyatta Prize last year. Yeah.
Congratulations.
And the other one won the BAT Award for African Young Literature. Yeah. So so I think in total I've done 13 books by myself, and collaborations with others is 8 books, so 21 books that have contributed to. Including Nairobi Noah, which is an anthology of Kenyan writing.
Ah, that's great.
Which you should read, by the way.
I have it.
Yeah,
it's supposed to
read.
It's supposed to be my next read, actually. I stopped it so that I could read Last Villains of Molo. Okay.
Read my story there.
I shall.
Okay, yeah. Shameless plug.
No, because at the end of the day, you have to be proud of your work and you have to talk about your work. Otherwise, no one will know about it.
Yeah. So I did a story there called Andaki, which is a very, just read it and then we'll talk.
And we will definitely talk. I love that.
Yeah.
Okay, so basically, my last question would be, because I've seen my time is coming up. What are you reading? Because we do have a segment called Nairobi's Reading. So I know even if you're in Singapore, you're still a Nairobian at heart. So what are you reading right now?
So I have a couple of books that I'm reading, I've just finished a book called The Monsters Under Your Bed, The Beast Under Your Bed, which is a book by Rogoi, James Rogoi. It's a new book. I have just finished another collection of another anthology called Digital Bedbugs, which has been edited by Makena Onjereka, who is a Kenyan. I should actually also talk to Makena as well.
You need to give
what I have
her.
In my
I am looking for her.
I will.
Yes.
I will definitely do that, yeah. So what I have next in my library is The Shadow King, Maza Mengitse. That's what I want to read. And then after that I'm going to read Manchester Happened by Jennifer Makumbi.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. At least those
and only because
right.
Kindle does not. Yeah. You've read those ones. So those are the two next things that are on my playlist. Yeah.
Okay. Fantastic. Thank you, Kinyanjui. KK.
Yeah.
It's been such a pleasure talking to you. And when I read Nairobi Noir, we're going to have another conversation about that. Thank you so much.
Sure. I'll be happy to hear your thoughts about the story.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nimeshukuru sana. I love my city. Oh, yes, I do.